Thank you for coming. I want to mention Master Atisha, the red-headed being, red-headed sublime being. The most beautiful statue I've seen of Master Atisha is at Kopan Monastery in Nepal. And just something, the face, it's so, you know, this one is also beautiful, but the face there, it's the sweetest. Each statue is a little different based on the, hello. It's been too long. I'm so happy you're here. We must talk. Yeah, like, must talk. I see some friends, old friends. And this is based on the statue maker. Statues, they really look different based on who has made them. And that one is extraordinary. If you can ever get a chance to go over to Kopan, to Nepal, I know it's far away and it's expensive to fly there, but it's very special to see. So if you come on our pilgrimage, I forgot to mention, we have a day in Kathmandu. We meet in Kathmandu. We have a day where I take you to kind of three of my favorite little off-the-beaten-track temples that are very special. One of them is actually three Tara statues in an ordinary courtyard. And they're said to speak to people. So you can check in and see if they speak to you. Very special statues. And then we fly up to the mountains. We walk from there slowly, trekking, through some of the most beautiful scenery you'll ever see. And then we actually do a three-day retreat at Laudo, which I would say is the purpose of Laudo, is you want to meditate there. It's a place for meditation. And it is a holy place built around this cave, again, that is very sacred, where Lama Zopa Rinpoche was said to have gotten enlightened in his last life. And it's a small cave, yet the place is really conducive for practice and meditation. So the first time I went to do retreat there in 1990, my first solo retreat, it was very primitive then. There was no running water or electricity. Now there is electricity, and they did, a year and a half ago, put this massive pipe in to bring water from another source. So Rinpoche's brother told me that if the pipe works and the spring is there, that he promised me that there would be a hot shower at Laudo, maybe. So I'm going to check it out and go up there and see. But that's not the most important part. It's really to sit there. And so when I first went, I was very concerned about discipline. Would I be able to do these sessions on my own when I was alone, not in a group? And I found I've never had issues there. It's so conducive to practice. So to do a three-day meditation retreat, I felt really the best way to use the place. Rinpoche's sister lives there. She's an older nun in her late 70s. She's a real character. So we'll be meeting her, hopefully. And then I take people after the retreat a day and a half around the area where we'll go to visit Rinpoche's birthplace, which is a two-hour walk away. And then below Laudo is a nunnery that has built a grand meditation hall in the last few years. And I know the nuns quite well, and I know people in that area. And then if we get really lucky, we may visit a nun who lives in a cave, a 20-minute walk from Laudo. And it's pretty extraordinary. Her father was the Lama of that region, Charak Lama. But what's interesting is we had a lot of good karma on the last pilgrimage, good group of people, and she's very private. And she's known me for years, so when I show up, like, her door's often, the outer door to the yard is closed, and I kind of call, and she'll look out an upstairs window. It's built into a cave, just the front wall is was made. And she'll look out, and she often doesn't open the door for people. So I've heard many people that have gone there and knocked and called, and she doesn't open the door. So when I've come, I'll either see her in the yard or whatever, and she is super welcoming, like throwing her arms around me to hug me. But I turned up with a group of 20. I love that. I turned up with a group of 23 people, and she's always feeding you. And if you go, the joke is at Cherok that it's very easy to break precepts there because she like insists that you eat, like, and you know. And so with 23 people, there was no way I was going to have her make even drinks for us. It's too much, you know, the firewood and 23 people, and then she has to wash all the cups. And so I just thought they could go in and kind of see the shrine and what it's like in a traditional house where, you know, where a lama lived. And so, and I didn't know if she'd be home. I didn't know if she'd be there. And anyway, we went, and then she insisted on everybody coming inside, and everybody got a cup of hot tang. They often make that. I got milk coffee. That was like a big esteemed kind of thing. That was amazing. So we had really amazing that she was there, and then everybody got to go in and sit with her, and she doesn't know any English, but yeah, it's amazing. So, and then we walk down to the plane, and we fly back down to a very, very nice hotel where you can have a hot bath. So anyway, if you're interested, but, and then we will visit Kopan Monastery, and you could see the incredible statues there as well. But this is such a beautiful Gompa, especially as Geshe-la has talked to you a lot about all the taras you have here to help remove obstacles. So just fantastic, all the 21 taras and that energy. So it's just a wonderful center. So thank you. So let's find that space, a little quiet meditation space now that we're here. You could lightly close your eyes and begin to bring the gaze inward. Again, if you missed last night's teaching, meditation posture, as corrected and as gone over again by Lama Zopa Rinpoche at the last Light of the Path retreat, you could watch a video of it. Your hands, which is the right palm on the left, with the thumbs pressed together at the navel. It's against the body at the navel, not down in your lap, so the arms will go out. Again, there's variations on the posture. Some people find this uncomfortable initially. You experiment. Again, the more your body sits in this posture, the more familiar it will be and the more comfortable it will be. So you can try that. If you see Lama Zopa Rinpoche going into a meditation in the teaching, you always see how he sits. So it's to be very effective for meditation. But slowly settle your mind on the breath, just a normal, natural breath, allowing the mind to settle here in the space. And an integral part of our meditation practice is coming from a relaxed place. So begin at the top of your head. Take a couple of minutes to scan down through your entire body, noting any places you're holding tension. Allow your inhalation to open up space in those areas, and allow an exhalation to release the tension. So let's reflect right now. If you missed it this morning, the exercise from last night, let's reflect for a minute on the good circumstances of your life. Really drinking in the appreciation for waking up in a warm, comfortable bed, in a safe environment. You have food, clothing, shelter, education, electricity, relatively good drinking water, relatively good air to breathe, loving family and friends, and on and on. Please reflect. And please deeply, as much as you can, experience gratitude for all of those wonderful, delicious circumstances of your life. One minute on reflecting on your good qualities. Your good qualities. You actually have many, even if you're telling yourself now you have none. The fact that you got yourself here into this room is a fantastic quality of interest and curiosity in something, a path that can make you happier. Perhaps boldness and courage to come here, even though it's an incredibly safe place. Maybe you bought flowers for people once in a while, took somebody out for a meal, bought someone a gift, helped your parents when you were a child. One minute, just reflect and really drink in again that gratitude for yourself, for those qualities. And think about from this place of having a precious or perfect human rebirth. You have every perfect opportunity now to transform your mind from suffering into happiness. Every perfect opportunity. And as a result of that, I can become a Buddha. Just think about that. Just reflect on that, and if you're a Buddha, you are unlimited then in benefiting all living beings. If that interests you, that's the Mahayana path, greater vehicle path. So please take that idea and you can fold it into a motivation right now. As we set a motivation for our time together today and all the activities of the rest of your day, please place your mind in as positive a space as possible. And if you'd like, include that idea of reaching a place where you're unlimited in benefiting all living beings. So from the reflection last night, I'll review. Speaking about this course, The Path to Joy, I'd like you to reflect on a moment or a time recently, if it's possible. If not, go further back. When you experienced a great deal of joy, I'd like you to put yourself back in that situation right now, as best as you can. And once again, have a look around the situation. Notice what you were thinking about. Are you alone or with others? If you are with others, who is there? You may notice who is not there. What are the activities? And have a look around at any other seasonal experiences. Is it day? Is it night? Are you inside? Are you outside? Just explore. A joyful moment. Can you next identify a non-joyful moment? What are the main differences between the joyful moment and the non-joyful moment? What can you identify as people or things that obstruct the joy? What is your mind state in each of these instances? What are you focused on in your mind? And have a good look around, again, the external conditions as well of both instances, both situations. Is there any adjustment you can make in the non-joyful moment, non-joyful situation? What sort of adjustment you could make that could shift this experience to joy? What prevents you from shifting the situation? So bring yourself here back in this room. And slowly, when you're ready, relax and open your eyes. What were any main differences that you noted between the joyful situation and non-joyful?
Was there
any big difference in the container, the circumstances around? Yes.
I'm sorry, outdoors versus indoors.
So is joy outdoors for you?
Yeah.
Outdoors, and then you're indoors. Okay.
Yeah. Just feeling confined is something I have to deal with a lot. And when I'm outdoors and connected with nature, it just feels great.
Okay.
I'm not obsessing over anything.
So in some ways, if I know something like that, there's times when people, if you want to be more buoyant, then some people know they have triggers of like, I need to get outside. I need to go for a walk. Again, we're going to be practical. Tibetan Buddhism is very practical. So it could be I just need to go for a hike, or I need to, you know, grab a friend and go for a walk or get outside. Some basic things, because you want to support the container to support the internal work. Sometimes we need those adjustments. Thank you.
For mine was also outdoors. But the secondary thing, and the thing that I think was more significant, is that I felt like I trusted the situation when I experienced joy. Like I wasn't questioning anybody's motives, or like I knew the people that were around me, and I felt like I trusted them, and I wasn't second-guessing anything. And in the situation where I wasn't experiencing joy, I felt like there was some chapter of the book that everybody else got that I didn't get. And I felt maybe left out or suspicious. I'm not sure what that is, but I felt like when I was experiencing joy, I got it. And I knew what I was doing there, and I knew how to act, and I knew how to go forward, and I knew how to really savor that experience.
Mm-hmm.
But when I wasn't experiencing joy, I was just out of sorts. I had no idea what to do.
And so we have that also with people we trust and people we don't trust. You know, there are people out there that have a different mode of operation. And so we're going to talk more as we get into some other exercises of going back into the non-joyful moment. Can I adjust it with kind of role-playing? Again, can I habituate my mind to deal with it in a most positive way, in a most beneficial way? So I'm not going to be spiteful to the people I don't trust. I certainly don't want to open this and say something really snippy to them, which just perpetuates, you know, more distrust and alienation. How can I deal with it? And how can I learn in the future to try to create situations where I'm around more trusting people, where I'm not even in those situations much? And if I am, how little it ends up disturbing me at some point. You know, you just realize everybody really, and I really truly believe this on some level, everybody's doing the best they can. Yeah, based on the information they have, their karmic makeup, they're doing the best they can. And like, I like to just offer that in my mind when I get frustrated with somebody, right? Because we're humans, number one, and that means we're flawed. We're prone to mistake. So I'm not saying we're bad. I'm just saying that's our nature. The nature of water is it's moist. It's wet. So, you know, I'm not in the middle of a swimming pool that's filled with water and suddenly I'm flailing around going, it's wet! Like it's a surprise. That's its nature. The nature of being a human is you're going to mess up. I mess up. So how can I not expect, when I see it in someone else, to kind of be less forgiving and less accepting? You know, people recently, you know, we have this thing going on in politics in the States right now, this whole impeachment thing that just went on. It was a total waste of time. We knew what it was going to be. But people attack, and people, I have friends trying to draw me in, you know, from my political life and this. Like everybody has to have an opinion. Americans are some of the most opinionated people I know. Like, you go to Asia and, like, nobody says anything. But, you know, I learned so much from my Asian sisters and brothers, but Americans, boom, I've got to get my view out there. My view, which is right, the best view, what I think, it's important. Really? So people trying to draw, you know, and I don't really want to talk about it. It's, I mean, I'm bringing it up now just to make a point, is how and people like to say, well, he's stupid and this one's idiotic. I think they're doing the, I mean, they, you know, people are limited. They're not Buddhas in Congress. I wish they were. It would be pretty cool to have more enlightened leadership, right? I pray for it every day. But right now, they're not. They're humans, and they're limited. And I do think each side is doing the best they can with the equipment that they have, the information they have. I'm more peaceful in that process. I'm not blaming they're stupid, you're, you know. It's about your mind being peaceful, like that. It convinces me more of my path, having been in politics, right? Some people ask me about what I did before I'm in politics. I'm like, that's why I'm a nun now. It's really easy. Okay, let me just get this out. So thank you for the comments. So we're going to work on, you know, how we deal with these, with some people that are a little bit more challenging. They will always be there in samsara, right? That's samsara's nature. Okay, now I also want to do a little review, because it was interesting yesterday how little we knew about precious human rebirth, right? So what's important is, and this is what the teachers did traditionally, is the teaching was given, and they would just read from text. That's the Tibetan style. You have your text, and they would just read. And then at the end of the teaching, they would summarize the same thing that they taught. They would repeat in a shorter synopsis. And the beginning of the next class, they would repeat again. So by the third time, something's going in. More has gone in. Okay? So I'm interweaving the Lam Rim through the path of joy and the eight pillars of joy. I think they fit well together. And we were talking about, I'm using some notes from the Book of Joy, which some of you have read. And if you haven't, I highly recommend this book, of a meeting of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And here they are kind of dancing on the back. In Dharamsala. Part of it was in Dharamsala, India, I think, some years ago. And it talks about how they have found their way to joy through having some very serious conflicts in their countries, one of whom has lost his country, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And his people have gone through tremendous suffering, as both of their countries have. So as we got into, in this meditation we just did this morning, very brief, is the beginning of joy starts, and it starts for me when I wake up in bed in the morning. And I find the more you can habituate yourself with positive thinking, more and more and more. But what happens is we have other habits. And we discussed last night how much time goes by before you reach for your phone in the morning to do something other than shutting off the alarm. Okay? And some people said they immediately reach for their phone. What are you doing on your phone? I have some practice on my phone that I read if I reach for the phone, right? But other people are doing other things on their phone often. First thing in the morning, like waking moments. Why not get your mind oriented in a better way in those moments? I know people that are buried under their lists and agendas for the day. They wake up with a groan, like, oh my God. You don't need, that's just a habit. That's just a habit. I mentioned last night, somebody I know, their habit, when I ask them, they just have a very kind of choosing suffering mentality. That's the way they live. We know people like that. So when I ask them how they are, you know, I come in, hi, how you doing? I haven't seen them. How are you doing? This is their response. I'm exhausted. Okay. As soon as I hear that, I'm exhausted watching. Like, you don't have to be that way. There's a choice. If you're exhausted all the time, go to the doctor and find out why and start sleeping. Sleep's a big, important factor in joy, right? But for this person, it's simply a habit. This is what they've known for years. This is what they know. So they complain a lot. They always choose that. I find that really tiring. So again, if you're motored over by your lists in the morning, try something different. Try something different. How to wake up. How about appreciating circumstances of your life, positive circumstances, and your good qualities, and then set a motivation. 3 minutes. That's it. Okay, I find it really useful. And initially you're going to forget. How many people forgot this morning that were here last night? Yeah, it's very easy to forget. Thank you for being honest, right? Very easy to forget. So leave notes. Make the phone go off with an alarm that says that, you know, you look at it and you go, oh, right, practice. Or motivation, or put it into your own words. Leave a note on the bathroom mirror. Like that. Okay. So I just find starting the buoyancy there. We have a fantastic situation. I don't know all your stories, but looking around this room, come on. Right? We have a pretty good deal compared to like South Sudan and people, you know, infected with the coronavirus right now, people living in poverty-stricken areas of our country, like that. That's not what's going on in this room, necessarily. So the beginning is, and then appreciating your, so that's an unconventional way of meditating on precious human rebirth, which we talked about last night. But as a review, I'm going to ask you about the 18 situations. I just want to know what landed in your mind without looking at your notes. How do we categorize them, number one? What makes up a precious human rebirth?
Eight freedoms and 10 endowments.
Thank you. Somebody's doing their homework. Eight freedoms and 10 endowments, or sometimes called richnesses. 18 situations. Eight freedoms. Let's focus on the eight freedoms. These are eight situations we are free from. What do you remember?
We're not hungry
goals. Yeah, that's number two. We're free of being in other realms. One of them is the hungry ghost realm. Hell realm, number one. Free from being hell. Free from being hungry ghost. Free from being an animal
or a god.
Those are four. So it's easy to remember that because it's four other realms. We got the other realms. We know what those are. So those are four of the eight that you're free from. Okay? What else are we free from? Time when there's no Buddha. Thank you. No Buddha existed. So last night we were considering, you can do a little meditation on, and I mentioned, this is how you'd analytically, if you weren't here last night, how you'd analytically meditate. You take one a day, okay? Maybe one a day. One or two a day you can work on. 10 or 20 minutes. Deeper reflection. Close your eyes, like, no Buddha existed. I'm free from that, but no, imagine the world without a Buddha. Okay, no Kadampa Center, no prayer books, no pilgrimage to Lao, no Buddhist nuns, no Buddhist teachings, no prayer flags, no stupa, no Dalai Lama, no books by the Dalai Lama, no books out here in your library. None of that would exist. You wouldn't know Geshe Gelug like that. So you really imagine what it would be like on the planet. No Dharma, No Buddhist teachings like that. There'd be other spiritualities, but no Buddhism. You know, and then you think, wow, I'm free from that. And then place your concentration on that experience, that succulence, that relief, to deepen it. 10 or 20 minutes like that. So you go through each one. What else are we free from?
Defective senses.
Defective senses, thank you. You know, if you're mentally incapacitated, it's very hard to practice Dharma. That's the reality. Very hard to practice Dharma. You're free from being in a place with no Dharma. Saudi Arabia, It's illegal to practice Dharma there publicly. That's not the United States. We're free to practice anything we want. Such, so great about this country, actually. You know, we want it. People complain about the states. I've done it at times like that, but having traveled so much around the world, this is one of the freest places for most people, I'd say. And especially looking around the room, I can't say that always for people of color, but for white people, I think we're pretty free like that. It's pretty amazing, the freedoms you have like that. We're also free from holding wrong views, and that ultimately relates to emptiness, the view of emptiness, but it could be dismissing the Dharma as garbage. That would be holding a wrong view. Different than being discerning. Discernment's really important. Please check up on what I'm saying like that. The Dharma has to be your experience like that. We have 10 endowments. How are they divided up? 10 endowments or richnesses. How do they divide those up?
Personal and environmental.
Thank you. Personal and environmental. Thank you. Let's look at the personal ones. What do you remember from this?
We're human.
We're human. Thank you. Number one, we're human. We're born in, they say, the center of a religious country. That means a place you can practice Dharma because they're related to the freedoms. So, yep, we're born in a country we can practice Dharma. Well-functioning body and mind. Again, free from having defective sense faculties. So they relate in order to remember. We haven't committed any of the five heinous crimes. Killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat, who's one who's reached nirvana, extracting blood from a Buddha with harmful intent, and causing a schism in a spiritual community. Those are heavy, heavy things. If you've done any of those, you can't get enlightened in the same lifetime, but you can purify anything like that. And having faith in the Dharma is a personal endowment that you have. You have some faith in the Dharma when you're here. Maybe not convinced of everything, but some faith. In circumstantial endowments, what do you remember about this? What's the circumstance around your being able to practice Dharma?
Is that a Buddha?
That there's a Buddha existed. Yes, a Buddha has existed, a Buddha's taught, and the teachings are furthered, and things like that. Teaching, I would say the Dharma exists and flourishes. Look at Kadampa Center. There wasn't this thing in Raleigh, and then, boom, a community got together through all of your support, and they created this center. Fantastic. And then we're born. And they all say in a fortunate period, each of these endowments, in a fortunate period, there are eons of existence in Tibetan Buddhism, and sometimes they're unfortunate periods where Buddha doesn't exist. A Buddha exists but doesn't teach. Can you imagine? Somebody gets enlightened, but they don't tell you how they got there. The next Buddha that comes, Maitreya, I'm sure you have a statue somewhere of Maitreya. Maitreya is seated more European fashion. Like, you know, on a throne sitting like we sit in a chair. Maitreya represents loving kindness. So Maitreya, I'm sure you've seen pictures. I can't see one here. But you don't have one? Okay. You got to get one of the big statues. they were offering, Lama Zopa Rinpoche was offering life-size statues of Maitreya at one point. I was at Milarepa they said the first few centers that were, anyway, and it's cool. And it's a lightweight statue made out of some kind of resin. Anyway, they have it in a corner. Some of the sisters have these big statues of Maitreya. Loving kindness is what he represents. He's the next Buddha, they say, that comes in a fortunate eon. You say, however, he doesn't teach Tantra. He doesn't teach Tantra. So you don't get the quick path. But right now, Shakyamuni Buddha, we have everything available to us. And the teachings are disseminated a lot now, all over. You can find tantric initiations, but you have to be careful and be discerning. Make sure it's the right teacher, somebody authentic that's qualified, like that. So, again, being born in a fortunate period where there's pure followers of the Buddhist teachings, like monks and nuns. And then being born in a fortunate period when practitioners can enjoy kind support. So the fact that there's benefactors for this center like that, there's some people that help monks and nuns to live, like things like that. that contribute or help the Sangha fund or things like that. So that's the only way all this exists. That's what makes up those 8 freedoms and 10 richnesses or endowments make up a precious human rebirth. So if you traditionally want to learn those, fantastic. And you try to meditate analytically 1 or 2 a day, and that is an antidote to anxiety and depression. So people that do suffer from anxiety and depression, that's the main meditation to do. And I know years ago, low self-esteem as well. Years ago, a monk friend of mine who's a great yogi, we were at the same center for a while together and getting to know him better and things. And I, for a long time, especially in my teenage years, in my 20s, I think I suffered from low self-esteem. And I noticed he didn't really have that. You know, one time I said to him, I said, you don't really, and then we were in a Buddhist community, so there were a lot of different dramas going on. You know, we say, as the Dharma turns, we call it. As the drama turns, right? And there'd be little things, and I noticed that most of these things arose out of people's insecurities, right? Coming from low self-esteem. And one time I said to him, and I said, you don't really seem to suffer from that. Like, you're not worried about what people think about you, and you kind of let stuff go pretty quickly if somebody had some confusion about something you said. And I said, how's that in your mind? How does it sit in your mind? And he goes, I meditate on precious human rebirth. Like over years, he had done it a lot where he felt like, I have a wonderful life. You know, I'm doing the best I can. I'm using this life. Fantastic. And it really gives you a buoyant inner tube to rest on. That's your foundation. That's part of the foundation. That's the beginning of the Lam Rim. Leads you into the Lam Rim. So it's the beginning of our philosophy. And there's a reason. You need to be buoyant. And you need to be on a rational basis to practice Dharma. And when you have that, what's the problem? You know, why be insecure? What's that going to do for you? It's like, I understand there's insecurity in there from habit. We're changing the habit, simply changing the habit. So you have to apply and make some use of this rather than just coming in and you hear the blah, 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 and then you go home and then you're playing, I don't know what these things are, on your phone. I saw the woman next to me on the plane yesterday. So just a short plane ride, an hour and a half, and the whole time she was doing some game on her phone. Hour and a half of your time. To be reading something or, you know. I mean, I don't know what she thought of me because I'm on the planes doing my mantras and, you know, like I know that. I try to do them quietly on planes, but I've always practiced to do it and I don't care anymore. I just do it. New York subway. I mean, there's a bunch of crazy people on the subway anyway. So for me saying some mantras, am I any crazier than them? Some people smile. I think they get it. You know, sorry I peeked over at her, what she was doing. You know, you want to see what people are doing. Interested. So precious human rebirth. This is your grounding. This really keeps the mind buoyant. And even that simple reflection of your good circumstances and good qualities, I think it's so essential. But you have to put it into practice if you want to fix your anxiety and depression and other mind states you've got that are negative. Okay? Beginning. Okay. We also mentioned how rare it is. And one thing I want to address, when I said you're free from being in the animal realm, how did that sit with people? That's okay with you? You don't think that your dog is the smartest thing on the planet, and how can you say it's not great to be your dog or to be your cat? Any thoughts? Because we had a little discussion when I got home last night. Some people debate with me about my dog is... Okay, so your pets, some of your pets, looking forward to seeing one of your pets tomorrow or today. People that have pets, your pet, I want to just say, that realm, that part of the animal realm is the peak of the pyramid of the animal realm, the very top, very small. Most animals live in the sea, and the animal realm is consumed with eating, getting food to eat, killing food, killing to eat. fighting with other animals over territory and mating rights and food, sleeping, going to the bathroom, and making more animals. That's the animal realm for the most part, the vast pool of the animal realm. And working. Like, do you ever see ants, you know, carting off a crumb? You see them, like, the crumb's like three times their size, and they're like, I mean, so industrious, that level of ants. But it's all about food for their colony, for their community, like that. And so that's most of the animal realm. And there's no animals, I don't see any animals in here studying Dharma. So when you really get down to it, people go, my dog's so smart. Well, your dog ain't here. So I'm glad your dog is smart, but I haven't seen. I lived with several cats, and none of them ever opened a Dharma book to be able to read a Dharma book like that. So that's just kind of the reality of the animal realm. Okay, let's go on the book of joy. How do we bring more joy? And we did, just as a small review, we talked about some scientists are mentioned in this book, neurological studies, research, and they were identifying that some of them mentioned that there's basically four kind of emotions that run us. And they mentioned three are negative. The one is happiness and joy is the positive one. But what we tend to get blocked in is fear, sadness, and anger. And I mentioned how anger, be cautious, because anger is the bodyguard for fear and sadness. So there's nothing wrong with peeling that back and getting down to your fear and sadness and exploring and looking at that, because that's part of the human condition. But what's hard is when people armor up because they don't like the vulnerable place that fear and sadness has put them. And when you armor up and get angry and hostile to people and then we lash out at others, it makes it even worse, right? So when you can just acknowledge, like, I'm really having a hard time right now, or I'm really afraid of this person, or I'm afraid to do this, I'm afraid to give this talk, or I'm afraid about the presentation. I hear people, it's like, that's so real. Like, yeah, that can be scary. Like that. I forget, I was talking to somebody the other day that was talking about, you know, when you have health issues, and somebody that suddenly couldn't see out of one eye, and somebody that had pain in their chest, and that's scary. It's scary. But there's people that armor up. Like, I'm fine. I see people. I'm fine. I don't need to go to the doctor. No. It's okay. Or they get angry at somebody because they're suffering. So this is just about stripping back to understand. But then we have happiness operating. And then this is very key. Three factors that seem to have the greatest influence on increasing our happiness and our ability, okay, the happiness. And here's number one, our ability to reframe a situation more positively. It's always an option for you. The ability to reframe a situation more positively. Fantastic, that one. And there's people that are constantly reframing in a negative way, right? Like, I'm exhausted. You know? Well, yeah, you're going to be exhausted if that's your mantra. I'm exhausted. I know people that have had everything thrown at them, every negative thing thrown at them. And I'm going to talk a little bit later. Anthony Ray Hinton, who was a guy on death row for about 30 years, innocent, 30 years imprisoned on death row, who was released. There's a number of people like that. Most of them people of color, because they were poor, in the wrong place at the wrong time, couldn't get proper legal representation. They ended up with life sentences or on death row, and they didn't do it like that. If you're familiar, there's a film out now called Just Mercy. It's about the book Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. I highly recommend the book. He's one of my heroes. Just Mercy, Bryan Stevenson. Or go see the film. I haven't seen it, but he represents people on death row and has gotten many, many people off that were innocent, that didn't have proper legal representation and things like that. It's pretty extraordinary. And I think he also may have argued in front of the Supreme Court, so it is now unconstitutional for a child to be sent to prison for life without parole. I think because of him. So it's, you know, it's about time. And I think he started the Equal Justice Initiative in Georgia and runs that, but he travels and speaks and the book's about these cases. So we'll talk about that a little later too. So your ability to reframe a situation more positively. Here's number two. Greatest influence on increasing your joy, your happiness. Your ability to experience gratitude. That's how I start my day. Your ability to experience gratitude. If you're not patterned that way yet, practice. Please practice it. And that's how I started practicing in the morning. I'd rather wake up with that going on and then setting a good motivation than, your lists and your agenda are going to be there all day. Get your nice buoyant inner tube there of hope and joy and peace, and then deal with your list from that grounding. You're going to do it much better. And any time of the day, what's available to you is to reestablish your motivation. You know, you're 2 hours into the day, doing all your stuff. Here comes a colleague, some worker, and you don't really like them. And now they're telling you can't have this on your budget or you can't do this, or we're going to change something and you don't like it. And there you are. And they leave your cubicle, your desk, whatever, and now you're like angry. Okay, what do you want to do? Recall your motivation. I'm on the Mahayana path. I really want to become a Buddha to benefit all living beings, including that person I don't like. That's challenging. I know it's challenging, but that's the work I've got to do, especially with that person. That's the work I have to do. It's about showing up to benefit all living beings, all living beings. Not excluding this one and that one and not practicing equanimity. I like these people, so I'm going to help them, but I don't like these people. No, it's all living beings. Let me just reestablish that right now for a moment. Let me just think about that for a second. Take a deep breath. Take another deep breath. Okay. You can do that all day long. 2 seconds, just reorient. You're in traffic, little tweak by this person that just cut in front of you. It's your motivation. You're ready to call them a jerk and give them the finger? Motivation. Wait a minute. Okay, I've been in the same situation as them, cut in front of somebody. Yep, we're all human. And once again, I like to say to myself, we're all doing the best we can right now. I really believe in people's fundamental goodness. Fundamental goodness. Do they sometimes look like they're idiotic and saying stupid things? Yeah, they do. But that's only my perception. It's only my perception. Okay, there's other people that see it differently. Okay, so anyway, we've got reframing to something positive, ability to experience gratitude. Number three, greatest influence on increasing happiness, your choice to be kind and generous. Always have that option. You always have that option to be kind and generous, to choose that. Choose kindness. I said that last night. I think somebody... Is it Jennifer? Who's Jennifer? She was here last night, I think. Anyway, she was posting stuff on Facebook. She must have posted she quoted something from me about choosing kindness, because I was trying to post another poster for the next teaching I give or something and saw this little reminder. So again, nice level there of orienting our mind with joy. So check in your own mind. Am I not reframing to the positive? Am I a negatively critical person? Is that one of your habits? I used to be. I was the biggest negative critical person I've ever met. And when part of it was my karma, I take ownership. But that created a cause for me to be raised in that kind of environment. Is that interesting? I'm not blaming these people. I'm just saying I created that. It came from my mind. There was an environment, incredible negative criticism. So it was just, that's what I thought was the right thing to do. That's what everybody did. And da 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 da. And then I learned in Buddhism, I was like, I really like being that way. It puts people off slowly. So retraining. I notice that. I can reframe now in a more positive way. But I do notice that seed subtly still comes up at times. And I'll be like, yeah, well, that's just me mouthing off about. And then I'll be like, enough. Okay, back to the practice. Okay. So a lot of religions have a strong conviction that we can't discover lasting happiness through our senses. Okay? So while you get temporary enjoyment through your senses, it's really inevitably fleeting and not the source of enduring satisfaction and contentment. Okay? So that's something to notice. The Buddha's saying is, trying to seek happiness through sensory gratification is like trying to quench your thirst with salt water. It will only make you thirstier. It's part of the nature also of the desire realm. Like that. So just knowing that, like, we sometimes need a break. I just said to somebody the other day that was kind of feeling guilty about, I forget what she did, she went to a spa and I said, well, maybe you needed that. Like, why are you getting down on yourself? You need breaks like that sometimes. In balance. To do it in balance. You want to play your little computer games? An hour and a half? How about 15 minutes? 15 minutes? You know, I have a girlfriend I spent last summer. She's always inviting me. They have this house at the beach that was her parents' house. So she's every summer she invites. And finally, last summer, I made it there for a few days to visit her, New York. And there were five of us there, and it was really delightful and relaxing and fun, and, you know, her husband's cousins, and they were just really nice. And then finally the cousins left, and it had been quite busy of engaging with five people, and we were either doing this or making dinner or talking about this, or there seemed to be these activities. And then finally the cousins left. It was just me and her husband, and I'm very close friends. And then all of a sudden she looked at me, and she's just like, I just need to play my computer game for a moment. Like, she hadn't had the time to do it, so I said, play your game. Sit down and have your game. Like, she just needed, like, the moment not to talk to somebody and do something. But within balance, right? In balance, whatever your sensory treat is, we need some uplifting. So within balance, but no, that's not going to be, the box of chocolates is not the source of lasting happiness. I'm sorry to break it to you. Okay. And it's nice with when we do get into a thing, if it's about food for you, we have food prayers, food offering prayers in Tibetan Buddhism. Okay? Viewing this meal as medicine, I shall enjoy it without greed or anger, not out of gluttony, nor out of pride, not to fatten myself, but only to nourish my body. Like that. To take that moment to think about what you're eating and all that went into it and the people that, all the beings that brought it to you, all the beings that may have been harmed as far as the food coming to you, and a little bit like that. Can I keep my energy up for this retreat, this practice, this day, my work, my family, whatever it is, to be buoyant, positive, to practice Dharma, to get enlightened, to benefit all living beings? Then I practice the yoga of eating. It's very different than diving in, you know, stuffing our face, inhaling. We're so hungry. You're just shoving food in like that. Not really much benefit. You can change anything to a virtuous activity based on your motivation. Like that. I mean, any activity, obviously not negative activities, but something positive like that. Okay. And I do want to mention, okay, there's our little schedule. It's always so good. 12:30. Okay, so we're going to take a break in about 15 minutes. Just a short 15-minute break, and you can go to the bathroom, have some tea, like that. Okay. So when we speak of experience happiness, we need to know there's actually two different kinds. The first is an enjoyment of pleasure through the senses. So we have that kind of more mundane kind of experience. Sex could be an example of that as well. Okay. But you can also have an experience happiness at a deeper level, as we know, through our mind, okay, through love, compassion, loving kindness, generosity, okay. What characterizes happiness at the deeper level is a sense of fulfillment you experience. Fulfillment. While the joy of the senses is brief, the joy at this deeper level is much longer lasting. This is true joy. Deeper contentment, I'll call it. And I've talked about this before in here. When you find deep meaning in your life, when you find meaning in life, and I hope a lot of you right now are living from meaning, finding meaning in your life. And what would you say is a component of that for you, if you're finding meaning in life? What's a component What's one of the key components?
Others.
Others, thank you.
Gratitude.
Others, gratitude. What else? Anything else?
Being connected to your authentic self.
Yep. Yeah, I think all those things. Being connected to your authentic self. I think the real focus, the predominant focus is others. Number one, that I'm focused on leading my life in a way to benefit others. To benefit, like I'm keeping that in my motivation. So when I get off balance, which I do often as a human being, we all do, right? I'm checking. Oh wait, right now I'm a little bit in it for what's in it for me. And then I'm like, wait, let me reestablish the motivation, and then okay, now I've got some buoyancy and balance, and now I'm okay. You know? And also not beating myself up when I started thinking about myself. Really important part of it, not beating myself up. You know, low self-esteem likes to hold you hostage. You do something wrong and you're no good. You're a screw up. You never do anything right. And all the negative things like that. It's simply not true. It's just that I'm a human being and the tendency is sometimes I think about myself. That's all. Period. End of that thought and on to the next thing. Oh, my motivation. Oh, great. Yeah. I'm actually okay. Because in the morning I remember thinking about my good qualities. Yeah. I do a lot of good stuff. Instead of giving all the airtime to what everything you do wrong. We've talked about this before. Did you ever notice? You get complimented. People get complimented at work. You did a good job. Has that ever happened to you at work? When you get your raise or your review? Yeah. How does that feel? Do you acknowledge that and you feel pretty good about it? Great. Pretty balanced. How do you feel about it? You were nodding or no?
Yeah, it did. It makes you feel like you're worth something.
Okay. And can you say thank you? And like, thanks, that's good? Everybody, good? That's good? She's nodding as well. Everybody feel that way?
Not all the time.
What happens? They say something good, and then where does your mind go?
Nothing. No, not really. Yeah.
Right. Not really. I don't know. You know, and then when something doesn't go well and there's a project and the boss will say, could have done this better or this part, you didn't finish that part, or we really need to improve the standings and the ratings and the money from this, and then what happens in your mind? How's that go for you? Write down in the back. And do you focus on anything positive that you do? If you're paying attention, right? But do you ever dwell on what you dwell on it, right? That takes up a lot more space in the mind than great job. Just got a raise and we want you to be here and we really love you being at the company. I kind of poo-poo that. Well, yeah, okay. You know, but then they say one little thing and can you improve the thing? And then I obsess about that for a month. So equal airtime balances the mind. Realizing I do need to improve these things. And I'm good enough to do it. And I'm planning to do it. Period. End of the ruminating thought. No more ruminating thought. Don't let the habit of carrying it on in your mind, the negative thing. Let's call it constructive criticism. Okay. If it is truly constructive, not all managers are great managers. So they might say things in wrong ways, you know. It's also our job to try to help people be better managers and leaders when we can in constructive ways by giving feedback when we can in a good way, whether it's privately or with a group of people but in a way they can hear. But constructive, so constructive criticism is constructive. So it doesn't need to go into a negative space in our mind. It's a positive thing too. It makes us better. Especially if it's given from a good leader and in a good way. And that's going to make me better. The feedback I've gotten at centers from a wonderful staff we had at Vajrapani Institute that fed back to me about my management style. Nobody trained me to manage them at this center. I did the best I could, and I really messed up at times. And then how wonderful that some of the most gracious people there met with me privately in such a sweet, kind way to tell me what wasn't working for them and to give me examples. And I was like, you know, it was hard to hear, but then I took it in because I really valued and respected them. They're great, great people to work with. And I really had to reflect a little bit back in my practice and say, yep, I do that. And thank you so much because I'm going to do it better. And I did. So that was fantastic to do that. But so it's humbling, which is good. You know, we all need some humbling at times, some of us. And then how to present back out there, to take it in, but not to overthink it. You know, I didn't have to spend the next month of, I'm terrible, I'm, why am I here, I'm horrible, I didn't want to be here, you know. No, it was just like, well, they're really right about that, and these are ways I can improve it, and that's the end of it. Leave your mind space for all the other things you want to do, think, and be. Why continue some negative ruminating thought in the mind? It's simply habit if we're used to doing it. Some of us are overthinkers. We work on that. We practice to stop the thought. I've already thought about it enough, been through it enough. Thank you very much. And you see the thought coming. Thanks very much. I'm moving you along now. Take your hand. Move it along if you need to. Honestly, visually it's helpful. I've thought about you enough. I spent all last month thinking, done. People have this with health issues before they get to the results of the biopsy. Over and over, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I have cancer, I have cancer, I have cancer. You don't have cancer yet. You don't know that. Doesn't help. I know it's a panic mode. Some people have panic mode. I got a call in November from a friend with the blood test because she had had cancer years ago. And she's a Dharma practitioner. And she said, you know, when she called me and she said, I'm having a complete meltdown right now. Like the doctor called. And this is raised, this level, and oh my God. So we just kind of worked on it there in the phone call. By the end of the phone call, more relaxed. You know, let the spike happen. Notice, like, okay, I'm freaking out. And then let it calm down. Just call it what it is. As we know from, I've mentioned this. So there's a neuroscientist, a neuroanatomist, Jill Bolt Taylor. Some of you have read this book, My Stroke of Insight. She had a stroke at the age of, like, I don't know, 37. Major stroke. She recovered from it fully. It took her many years. And because she was a neuroscientist, she knew what was happening. But she's also mentioned neurological activity separate from the mind. Neurological activity takes place in the brain. Tibetan Buddhism believes it's the mind that engages the neurological activity and tells it how it's going to be, how it will function. The karmic imprints and seeds planted in your consciousness, separate from the brain. But she was just talking about neurological activity, and when you have a thought that comes through the brain, how it gets engaged in the brain, and we mostly notice this with periods of great drama, when there's a spike, either through great attachment, great fear, great anger, boom, like that. And how long do you think that lasts in the mind, that experience, let's say going through the brain? What would you say?
Seconds.
Yeah, she says it's 90 seconds. So I discuss this with my friend on the phone as well. And I do it for myself if I notice there's a little moment. Is I allow myself the 90 seconds. Without reacting and responding, I just... like, notice the adrenaline rush. I start deep breathing a little bit, like just going, okay. I estimate 90 seconds. And then roughly around the end of that, I really practice letting it go and reorienting my mind in a more rational way. Okay, what do I need to do about this? Like, if there is great alarm, great fear, and you're in a dangerous place or somebody's trying to attack you or somebody just said something really rude to you, or you're really attached to something, or you find out that somebody died, or you got a bad diagnosis, any of these situations that happen, lost your job, you know, something like that, relationship breakup, is 90 seconds. Fear, sadness, utter shame, whatever you go through, and then, okay, so what am I going to do about this? Is there anything I can do about it? Rationally review with a motivation of compassionate wisdom, then act. And maybe you realize there's nothing I can do about it. Mm-hmm. Let it go. Relax. With her, she had to wait for the secondary test they were running. So there was nothing she could do except wait for the test. So why be alarmed with your family? Why be full of and talking about it all the time? And, you know, we analyze. That wasn't going to work for her. So I said, when you notice that happening in the next few days till they give you the results, it was going to be like 2 or 3 days later, just say mantras. Can you just come up with a mantra right away? Right away. And notice the mind flipping out, but just go into the mantra. Take a deep breath. Go out, if you're in an area, go smell the flowers, or go take a walk outside, or whatever your coping mechanisms, your positive, healthy coping mechanisms. Okay? Another neuroscientist, and this is similar to what we've been saying. He says, four independent brain circuits that influence our lasting well-being. He talks about, and this is similar, again, they all come back to this. This is first, they're talking about brain, because neuroscientists do. But more and more, they're understanding there might be something separate, like consciousness, that seems to interact with the brain. And he talks about our ability to maintain positive states. A second circuit is responsible for our ability to recover from negative states. Third circuit, also independent but essential to the others, our ability to focus and avoid mind wandering. And a fourth circuit is our ability to be generous. So it's interesting how these separate neuroscientists are coming up with similar things through their research. So, again, ability to maintain positive states, ability to recover from negative states. The separate one, ability to focus and avoid mind wandering, I find that very interesting, and ability to be generous. Okay, helps people maintain positive well-being. The first one we've talked about. The second one, recovering from negative states as well. Negative stuff happens to people all the time. We've got a lot of negativity in the mind. Dharma practice is a whole path of recovery. That's what we're trying to do, is transform the mind into something more positive. But there's a lot of recovery we need from past negative acts we've done. Negative experiences we've had, especially if you believe in reincarnation. So we work on that through purification practices, that we have active purification practices in this tradition. It's great because there's something I can do about it then. We have Vajrasattva practice, some of you are familiar with. I like to do it every evening. So a lot of people say to me, what can I do that I have this tendency to be like this? I was alcoholic. I really hurt my kid. I really did this. I did. What can I do? Vajrasattva practice, you can always do. Like, there's something you can do about it. You're not just left with, this is how it is, and people feeling horrible about themselves. But the third circuit, I find, I love this, ability to focus and avoid mind wandering relates to meditation. So I can't stress enough the importance of having a consistent meditation practice in your life as the other component to keeping joy flowing in your life. Because the meditation practice allows you to get to know your mind better and then to start to train your mind to keep it away from negative experiences, moving it into positive experiences. And the ability to be generous, I find really interesting. It's interesting, it's the first perfection, the perfection of generosity. It's from that perfection, the reason it's placed first, that the Dharma flows into your life and through your life. The generous spirit. It's not just about giving money. It's that generous spirit, right? Wishing this for all beings that pervades, that helps the Dharma manifest in your life, that helps so many good qualities arise. So many good practices come from that, keeping that flow going and creating all the right conditions to practice. And then a lot of people relate to joy through other beings, other people. Some people really like to be surrounded by friends and loving family and enjoy that space. Some people are okay being alone and finding the way. Not loneliness, aloneness. Aloneness is powerful. positive. Loneliness not is a delusion. But aloneness is, you're okay to, and it took me some practice. Now I think I'm sometimes more comfortable being alone. I'm kind of an extroverted introvert. Like where I renew myself is alone time. And doing a lot of retreats, you know, I'm used to being alone. The first time was unnerving, unbelievably unnerving. But once I got used to that, again and again, the first time you eat dinner in a restaurant alone, I know people that have never done that. I have a friend, she says, I can't. She goes, you went there by yourself? She goes, you went to the movies alone? She's never done it, never had the experience. Right? Now I'm in different cities. I travel a lot. Sometimes there I am alone in some city and people aren't picking me up till later. I'm going to go have lunch by myself, right? I'm used to it. It's okay. It doesn't bother me anymore at all. Like that. And I look like this. So people are looking at me. Like, what's going on over there? What is that? You know? I tell this story. It was so cute. I think I told the story in here, but I went to the car wash in my town to get my car washed. And the guys that work there are from West Africa. I went into the car wash, and before you get there, and they get out of the car, and they're vacuuming, okay? So he's asking me what kind of car wash I want, okay, and the thing. And he's trying to sell me a higher moneyed car wash. You really need to do this, and your roof, and then da-da-da-da-da. And I said, that's okay. I said, and I'm dressed like this. And I said, no, I just want the cheapest thing, just the one to just basically. And he goes, and then he looked at me, and he goes, well, he goes, you know, I needed to do that, the sales pitch. And I said, that's okay. But we're having a nice conversation. I said, no, I understand, but just the cheapest thing, that's fine. Totally works. And then I said, you know, I'm a Buddhist nun. I'm on a limited income. Don't worry, you know, the thing. And he's looking me up and down, and I see the other guy with the vacuum is really checking me out. He's really like, and finally he turns to me, and I said, you know, I'm a Buddhist nun. There's two of them. They're so nice. And I said, you know, I'm a Buddhist nun. I don't know if he exactly knew exactly what that was, but the other guy's looking at me, and all of a sudden he goes, with the vacuum in his hand, and he looks at me, and he goes, what are you? And then I said, I'm a Buddhist nun, you know, the Buddha spirit, you know, and then I was like this. And then by the time my car started to roll in, we're all like this to each other. Well, I said, thanks so much. And then I went through the building to pay, and, you know, it was so cute. He's like, what are you? So sorry, Celia, question.
You were saying about how we are used to being alone. How do you handle that when you are with people or with family? Does it create... It happens to me when I go back to Peru. I'm here. I don't see them. I'm not around friends. And now I'm like, I find it a little hard sometimes.
I go to the bathroom a lot.
Oh.
No, I'm joking. No, I'm joking. No, but the thing is, I also love people. I teach all over, and there's people coming, and I meet with students, and lunch and dinner, and every, you know. And so I also enjoy that, provided I get my alone time to decompress. Mm-hmm. If I don't, I start to get cranky. And I notice that. And so I also notice, this is about building your joy. When I said look around you in the meditation situations. So one of the things I notice that obstructs joy for me is when I'm really tired and still with a lot of people. Like I just know I'm really tired right now and there's too many people around me somehow, and then suddenly I'm going to snap. I'm going to say something that's going to come just because I'm tired. So I've learned those triggers already and know that when I'm really tired, and if I'm on the road teaching, it's easier with family because I can just say I'm really tired now. But when I'm on the road teaching and if there's like a late dinner or something, and sometimes I'll just say, you know, like to say to people, I need to be home at 9. Because I just know that at that point I'm going to be over and out if I'm teaching all day and things like that. Or I'll excuse myself if I'm at the home with people and they're having people, and I'll just say I really need to go finish my practice and just excuse myself like that before I turn into, you know, the Wicked Witch of the West, okay? So these are things to think about. We're going to take a break, 15 minutes. I want to introduce the concept of Ubuntu, which is in this book. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Ubuntu, from Africa. It says, a person is a person through other persons. A person is a person through other persons. And we might have, you know, how do we create more friends? But positive, how does that, if that's, a component of joy. What do you think about a person is a person through other persons? How would that relate to your joy? It's also how we're seen in the world and how we relate to other people, what we contribute to other people. So instead of blah, blah, blah at the break, I'd like you to discuss that. And also in your meditations that you did, maybe introduce yourself to somebody you don't know, meet them, and have a little dialogue about, in the meditations, what do you find obstructs your joy? And what's your mindset when you feel your joy is obstructed? What's your mindset when you feel it's humming right along? When you were in the joyful moment, what's the mindset like that? So you can discuss some things like that. And anything you'd like to talk about with Precious Human Rebirth, the 8 Freedoms, 10 Riches. So any of that you can talk about, okay? 15 minutes? Thank you. I'd probably say, so good. So good.
Picture things flowing.
Okay. I want to get into, I'm going to come back to some of my notes, but I want to get into the 8 pillars of joy. 4 are qualities of the mind. 4 are qualities of the heart. The 8 pillars of joy. Did we catch everybody who's out here? I guess everybody's back in. Okay. The first one is perspective. This is the first pillar of joy, qualities of the mind related to the mind. Perspective. And this is about reframing a situation more positively. Perspective, a healthy perspective really is the foundation of joy and happiness. Because the way we see the world is the way we experience the world. Right? It's either, I'm exhausted, and that's how you see everything, or it's, yeah, I'm ready for this. This is great. And that's what reflects back. Changing the way we see the world in turn changes the way we feel and the way we act. And that changes the world itself because you are part of the world. You're part of the world. So people that have this idea, I want to change the planet, I want to change the world, you are a part of the world. And when you change your mind, that change your mind more positively, that has an effect. Those ripples go out. Those ripples will go out there. And then there's a quote from the Buddha, but this is, I will just quote Lama Zopa Rinpoche, everything comes from the mind. Everything comes from the mind. Quote from the Buddha, Dharma, in the Dharmapada, with our mind we create our world. Okay, that's radically different than a lot of the religions we were raised in, that it's created by someone else, something external from us. But what if it's our minds that create the reality? Please check up on this, okay? I checked for a long time, and I found it fascinating how people have different attitudes, and they have different perspectives. And like I said again, there are some people, everything is viewed through some negative context. And then their lives, that's what reflects back to them. And they approach things with, like, you know, distrust and how somebody going to harm me and this is going to be a real pain and lack of energy. And then some people approach things with, okay, I've known people, you know, they say I got cancer and one of the people I noticed, now I don't know personally what this person's like, but I've always liked the show Jeopardy. Do you ever watch Jeopardy? This game show that's on in the evening. I used to watch with my parents. Sometimes when I visit them, and there's the host, Alex Trebek, I think his name is, who has pancreatic cancer. And I think he was diagnosed, like last March, like close to a year ago now. This is usually something that kills you in 3 months. So now you might say, well, he's famous and I'm sure he's got all the great doctors. Okay. Fair enough. But he right from the beginning was like, I'm going to beat this thing and I'm going to, you know, and he still wants to do the shows, and, you know, and he's going through chemotherapy and all these treatments. And I think his attitude, the positive attitude of, obviously support from friends and family, but it's all reflected back from his mind. The people are happy to support people that have positive attitudes often. You're very willing to sit through a chemo session with them as opposed to people that keep repelling everyone based on negative attitude. Perspective. His Holiness says, for every event in life, there are many different angles. When you look at the same event from a wider perspective, your sense of worry and anxiety reduces and you have greater joy. Okay? Again, every event in life has many different angles. Did you ever notice this? The same thing happens to you and a friend. I've seen this. And you have two totally different takes about it. Two totally different impressions. And I've noticed this. So the other day, my exhausted person, right, she went to a concert with another person in my life who's an upbeat. They went to this concert, and I asked them about it, and I said, how was it? And then the exhausted person said they didn't like the program, and da-da-da-da, and they were playing this, and it was boring. I mean, it was negative, 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 negative. And then the upbeat said, well, I didn't really know what they were playing, but I just kind of sat there, and I enjoyed it, and I was watching the instruments, and I, you know, all very positive. Same concert. Same show. What's your take on that? Interesting. I like that there's different, because it does teach me about emptiness, the different perspectives, so you realize that because things lack an inherent concretely exhausting impression or upbeat, we all have a different experience about it based on what's in the mind. I find that really interesting, and it does really teach me that the reality must come from the mind, because she's got a different view of it. He's got a different view. It's the same thing that's out there. So it's just what we're bringing to it. Our perspective towards life is our final and ultimate freedom. So your perspective literally has power to keep us alive or to cause our death often. Where's the woman who just told me about, right there. I forget your name.
Joyce,
about somebody who landed, a construction worker who jumped down from a thing, a nail went through his boot, okay, and he screamed in the most monstrous pain and whatever, and they had to give him opioids and they had to give him anti-anxiety drugs at the same time to control the pain. And when they took his boot off, the nail never pierced his skin. It went through it went in the space between his toes. So, you know, there's your perspective towards life. Like, you can be screaming in pain from the idea of what something looks like, what you think is going on, as opposed to the actual reality of what's really going on. And participate in that instead, because it's more balanced in a rational framework. So interesting that. So, Thupten Jinpa, who wrote A Fearless Heart. He's His Holiness the Dalai Lama's interpreter when His Holiness teaches in the West. He's a professor at McGill University. He's a wonderful guy as well. He explained that while changing our emotions is quite hard, changing our perspective is actually relatively easy. Okay, it's a part of our mind over which you have some influence. The way you see the world, the meaning you give to what you witness, changes the way you feel. It can be the first step of a spiritual and neural journey that results in more and more equanimity, more joy, like that. So again, influencing how, changing the emotions is more difficult, but that kind of perspective is an easier thing to start working with first, the broader perspective. I really like the zoom out approach. The zoom out approach. I knew we lost some people to the bathroom. So they're back. Looking relieved. So happy for you. So you're in the details of something that's going on. Do you ever get lost in the details? They're doing the, if I zoom out, I realize let me put it in perspective. You know, I think of people being infected with the coronavirus. I think of the Australian bushfires, burning people out of their houses, burning their pets, and So is this little thing right now that I'm worried about, is it really that big of a deal? I do need to take responsibility and deal with it, but again, in perspective, do I need to make a huge drama about it? I'm not dying right now. Okay? What if we were dying? How does that change your perspective? Okay? We're all dying. We're just not actively dying right now. But we're all on that path towards that ultimate transition. Okay? So I want to bring in the teachings on death and impermanence right now as part of the Lamrim, how this relates related to perspective. Okay? So we have a traditional 9-point death meditation that we do under 3 main headings. Some of you are familiar with this. 3 main roots, we say. And under each root are 3 reasonings that kind of bring that root home deeper into your heart that lead to 3 resolutions. And those 3 resolutions are about really picking up your practice and making it happen in a rich, consistent way. What do you remember, 9-point death meditation? What are the 3 roots to start with? Death is certain. Thank you. Death is certain. Number 2. Time of death. Okay, this one we know better than the 8 freedoms and 10 riches. Yay. Okay. The time of death is uncertain. Number 3. Third root. Not that one.
Nothing is going to help you.
What's going to help you? The Dharma. Your Dharma practice. The only thing that benefits you, thank you. The only thing that benefits you at the death time, thing that benefits you the most is your Dharma practice, your spiritual practice. Okay? Basically where your mind is what you're trying to say. Okay. 3 reasonings under death is certain. The first root, death is certain. 3 reasonings. What's number 1? Okay, now it gets a little more intricate.
The cause of death is birth?
Not that one, but good guess. Death is certain. Okay, number 1, everybody dies. There is no power in the universe that will stop death from coming to you. Right? Number 2, I think we need a little study here, okay? Number 2, every moment you're closer to death. As if you dropped out of a plane without a parachute at birth, every moment we're streaming to the ground. That's our death. It's coming. It's definitely coming. That's the heading. Death is certain. Every moment you're closer to death. You can reflect. We're another Saturday closer right now. Another February 1st closer. Another Dharma course closer. I'm another breakfast closer. I'll soon be another lunch closer to death. I'm another bathroom break closer to death. Right? Every moment passing away. Number 3, third reasoning. Anybody remember? The
time of death is uncertain.
Well, that's the second heading. That's the second heading. The
time to practice?
No, well, it's basically that there's very little time.
Well,
very little time to practice. But that's the resolution. We're going to get to that in a moment. But the third reasoning is, of a 75-year lifespan, the average amount of practice is about 5 years. Formal practice. Look at your day. How much do you sleep? People sleep about a third of their lives. So look at your work and your education and the time you spend, like, taking care of the body, washing, bathing, dressing, you know? How much time is spent on the computer games? Right? How much time, and all the other activities. Your relationships, getting in and out of your relationships, and cooking meals, and buying food, and I mean, how much time do you spend in formal Dharma practice a day? Do you get an hour a day, maybe? For those of you that are lucky, you get an hour, great. 1 hour of 24. So a 24th of your life, maybe. So it's not much. It's not much time because death is certain. Death is coming. And this leads to the resolution, I have to practice. I have to practice. Like that. I'll take questions in a moment. Yeah. I have to practice. Second main root. What's the second main root again? Time of death is uncertain. The time of death is uncertain. This root is the harder one to realize. Most people know you're going to die. We get that. We have it intellectually, not experientially. The meditation is designed for you to get it experientially. Okay? But for now, but the time of death is uncertain. People say all the time, oh, when I'm old, do you know if you're going to live to be old?
Nope.
You don't know. Okay? Time of death is uncertain. It has three reasonings. The first reasoning, anybody remember? Yeah, unfixed lifespan on planet Earth. We happen to live in a world system with an unfixed lifespan. Look at all the ages people die. 2 years old, 16, 94. There's no set lifespan. Buddhist cosmology says there's other world systems. One world system, you get 1,000 years. Everybody knows that when they're born, exactly 1,000 years, it's over. That's not planet Earth. People die, you don't know when you're going to die. Okay. Second reasoning, and the second and third are somewhat related. The second reasoning is there's many more things supporting your death than your life. Natural disasters, environmental toxins. Look at the fires in Australia. Look at the coronavirus. There's so many germs, bacteria, and viruses. A guy connected to our community in Santa Cruz, California, pretty white bread place, pretty clean environment, raking, dealing with his lawn, cut his toe with a rake, little cut, that night in the hospital fighting for his life with flesh-eating bacteria. You know? You kidding me? I couldn't believe it. Almost died. Like that. So you just don't know when one little procedure, you go in the hospital and you end up on a respirator with hospital pneumonia, and you were fine. Like that. Things like that go wrong. There's all kinds of things out there. Number three reasoning, your body is very delicate. So the car accident, the body is softer than all the elements of the car when it hits at a certain impact. It's not an earthquake that kills you. It's the building that falls down on your head that crumbles in an earthquake. If you're outside in an earthquake in nature, you just watch the trees move. Usually, unless you're at the epicenter where the ground opens up, but that's even more dramatic. It doesn't always happen like that. But mainly it moves. But buildings can't sustain it, and they fall down and crush people because this is softer than the building materials. But the body's quite delicate, and it gets infected with, you know, food poisoning kills people. So here you're trying to eat something that is for your health, and then some little tainted bacteria, and boom, you're dead from food poisoning. Happens to people all the time. Some weird, look at the coronavirus. How many, over 200 people I think have died. So it's like, it's a virus, and it's like having a really, really bad flu affecting the respiratory system. If you're a little bit challenged, your immune system's a little bit compromised, you may not be able to fight it off. Some people fighting it off, but not other people. This leads you, these three reasonings, to the resolution, not only will I practice, which is the resolution from point one, I will practice now. I have to get this going now. Third main heading is what? Third main root? Nothing helps you really at the death time other than Dharma practice. Okay? First reasoning. Anybody remember? That's number two. That's number two. Thank you. Number one, material things. Your money, your possessions are of no help to you when you're dying. Can they make you more comfortable? Yes. I've seen people, they're dying actively. They want to die at home. They want round-the-clock care. They want everything converted in the house. They can do it. They can afford it. They do it. Still miserable in their minds. Doesn't really help the mind. I've seen poor people dying peaceful, happy. So the money is really of no help. Friends and family, are they helpful? That's number two. What do you think about that? It depends. Depends. We just lost a dear brother in California, and he was moved to our hospice at Land of Medicine Buddha at the very end, and the reason was there's a lot of senior practitioners there that came together to do practices. I've been at that hospice doing practices for Buddhists that are dying, and fantastic environment in which to die. So if people are doing that for you, wonderful. But his dying experience was his alone. He was pretty ready. He was just super helpful to so many practitioners in the area, Jack. And at the end, apparently, he said, like, I just want to get this over with now. Like, I'm just ready to check out, ready to go. And but there are friends and family that are extremely attached to you, that, and you are extremely attached to, and they're begging you not to die. They're crying over you. They're fighting over your belongings over you. Not helpful. Okay? Friends and family, they're not going through the doors with you to your experience alone. Like that. Not so much help. Number three, your body's of no help when you're dying. It's usually the reason, part of the reason you're dying. Not supporting life. So this leads you to a resolution. After, I must practice. I will practice now. I will practice well, because that's the thing that will sustain me. So if you would like to add, this is what I do in the morning, my waking meditation, after the gratitude of my positive circumstances in my life, after the gratitude and appreciation for my good qualities, is the next thing I do, is the easiest death meditation, is today's my last day. And I would like to live it as if it is my last day. Okay? So I'm not creating my death. Some people said, oh, if you believe that, you're going to, you know, I'm still here. I do this every morning. Haven't died yet. But to live it as if 6 o'clock tonight, it's over for me. That's it. So it's not about what I want to do that day. It's how I want to be on my last day. How do I want to be? People say to me, okay, I'm not going to work. Last day. No, how do you want to be? You have to participate practically in your life. You're going to go to work. How do you want to be? And you notice this at work. Some of you have changed jobs. When you change jobs, and it was a job you really didn't like by the end, but the last day of work, and they maybe had a party, and did you ever notice how it doesn't look so bad here? It's like, even the guy I didn't really like, he's so nice today. Like, maybe I should have stayed. You know, like, it's because you're leaving. That's why it looks so good. Perspective. How different the perspective. If I'm actively dying, am I going to be fighting with this person about this thing, or arguing about this, or needing to make that point with these people, or being upset about this, or ruminating about what they're thinking about me? Focus on your mind being in a peaceful, happy place. Focus on care for others. You're dying? Do Tonglin, then. If I'm dying and I've got cancer or this disease, or I got crushed and they told me I don't have much time to live, why don't I just take on, every time I inhale, all the suffering on the planet of people experiencing this? And why don't I exhale and give them all the grace I've had in life and all the good experiences, and good health and happiness, peace of mind. And every time I take on the suffering and the cancer and all that, I'm not getting cancer, okay? But I'm going to let it diminish my self-cherishing. That's this constricted, yucky knot at my heart. I'm going to let it purify that. That's the only thing that makes me not happy, is self-cherishing. I inhale. I let it reduce my self-cherishing, and then because I've reduced my self-cherishing from a more spacious place, I offer every time I exhale to all the beings suffering from suffering in this way. Tonglin, I take the suffering, I offer the happiness. Take the suffering, offer the happiness. Maybe I do that. But that gives perspective any time of the day. People say to me, how do you deal with all the atrocities right now? What do you want to do with, you know, Tonglin? Like, I look at news generally once or twice a day, a quick news app I have on my phone, and I want to see what's going on. I like to know briefly. Sometimes I'm traveling and I need to know if some country, what's going on in the country, and I just look. And then if there's something really awful, right, I can do a quick Tonglin. That's what I can do, I say to them. You know? I mean, there's many things you can do. Give money to organizations volunteer for certain organizations. That, you know, on and on and on. You can write letters to Congress. But one thing I can just do immediately is some Tonglen meditation. And it really levels that perspective. Huge space of this pillar of joy. A little bit more in perspective. And this is from Jimpa, Tupten Jimpa. Perspective is nothing less than the skull key that opens all of the locks that imprison our happiness. What is this perspective shift that has such power? What's the healthy perspective that the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu bring to life that allows them to greet life with so much joy in the face of so much sorrow that they've experienced from their countries? The Dalai Lama uses the term wider perspective, larger perspective. He says it involves stepping back within our own mind to look at the bigger picture, to move beyond our limited self-awareness and our limited self-interest. Again, it's the self-cherishing that blocks us. A lot of times it blocks us. And as soon as you can zoom out and kind of say, well, you know, there's more going on here than just me and what I need and what's happening to me, to other people. So every situation we confront in life comes from the convergence of many contributing factors. The Dalai Lama explained we must look at any given situation or problem from the front and from the back, from the sides, from the top and bottom. Okay? Look at least 6 different angles, he says. That's how we often do analytical meditation, as I'm mentioning. Okay? In a healthy way. Okay? This allows us to take a more complete and holistic view of reality. And if we do, our response is often more constructive. So let me be clear about analytical meditation, which we're all very good at, okay? But we ruminate in negative ways about people, not healthy, not the right perspective. We do analytical meditation. You ever have a problem with somebody at work? And you come, and first of all, you ruminate, and then you go talk to a colleague. He does this, and he does that, and he's like that, and look at his stupid hair and his stupid shirt, and right? And I convince myself that the guy's a jerk, right? And then I go home to my partner, to my friend, to my kid, and I vomit it all out again. And then I call a friend and I vomit it out again. That's analytical meditation, not done in the right way, to convince myself the person is a pain in my butt. Not helpful. Because that person has good qualities, okay, that my negative mind is choosing not to see. So part of your exercise in that, with difficult people, is you have to consciously focus on some of their positive attributes. They are there. Hostility, anger, and hatred doesn't allow you to see it. Not seeing things accurately. So that's part of our work. When you focus on a small detail, it can lend to fear and hatred. And Jimpa offers another silver lining when you get stuck in the fear and hatred and negative thinking. He said, take something bad that happened in the past and then consider all the good that came out of it. That's happened as well. That's happened as well. Sometimes a negative situation can... I remember at Vajrapani there was something I really messed up. I can't remember. And out of that came a whole structure of we started to do group counseling together in narrative therapy, and it was brilliant, the work we did, but it came out of like a kind of bottoming out of some procedures going on there, not sustainable, not working. And it was really nasty at the time. All of us with negative speech talking about each other behind their backs and on and all these little divisive kind of things. And finally, fortunately, enough of us got sick of it. Renunciation. That's the beginning, the butt of renunciation. Finally, you have a negative pattern you're perpetuating, and you wake up at one point and you go, no, I can't keep doing this. I'm so ill right now. I cannot keep doing this again. I did it once with relationships, intimate relationships I was in. You know, we really muck them up for a while, don't we? I did. I did my best. I did my best. I wasn't totally a terrible person, but at one point I just kept perpetuating a certain habit until the guy left dramatically, pulled, and when I ran to the window and saw that his Jeep was gone, I kind of fell to my knees. I was really like, I couldn't believe that this, like, it got to this point after this big fight that we had, this big row, and I remember sitting there kind of crying and thinking, I'm not doing it like this again. And it was a really strong determination, and I never did. And all of my relationships since then were healthier and healthier and healthier like that. So I think that's a powerful place where you finally are down on your knees and you say, no, not like this again. I'm not doing it. From a wider perspective, we see our situation of all those involved in a larger context. And from, we also notice from a larger perspective, we're in a more neutral position. So we can have a more rational way of seeing. By seeing the many conditions and circumstances that have led to this event, we can recognize that our limited perspective is not accurate. It's not really the whole truth. Well, how about that? Until you have a direct perception of emptiness, your story is always wrong. Okay? Certainly, there's a valid perception in our story. You saw the guy hit somebody. Yep. But you have no idea all that went on around that, what's really going on. But we think we do. And then we act from there, we make opinions about it. As the Dalai Lama said, we can never see our own role in any conflict or misunderstanding. By stepping back, we can also see, he says, we can even, when you step back, you can see your own role more clearly. By stepping back, we can also see the long view and have a clearer understanding of our actions and our problems in the larger frame of our life. This allows us to see that even though our situation may seem challenging, you may still have problems in the situation, from the vantage point of a month or a year or a decade, these challenges will seem much more manageable. Okay? We do this with our kids. You know, your 13-year-old comes home from school with their obsessive whatever and the peer groups and the pressure and the... And you know that in the course of life, it will, people mature and it gets better, but at 13, it's a big real thing. So we lend some perspective. So it's the same thing in our own problems. I just want to focus and make this the big thing, but if I step back, it kind of relaxes. Oh yeah, okay. This is what I need to do. So another thing about, so people who have more frequently a kind of me, myself, and I process in their mind, it's all about me, have been proven to have a higher risk of heart attack, higher risk of the heart attack being fatal as well. Another researcher calls this so-called self-involvement, it was a better predictor of death than smoking, one researcher saw in their research. Interesting. Better predictor than smoking, than high cholesterol levels, than high blood pressure was your self-involvement. That's pretty interesting. And another researcher added on, people who tend to use first-person singular words, I, me, are more likely to be depressed than people who more often use first-person plural. We and us. So an interest of evidence being too self-regarding really can lend to unhappiness. Okay. We're going to take a break for lunch. Any questions right now? Anything we discussed this morning? Yes?
I just wanted to complete this book. Perspective is a small key that offers...
I just wanted to hear the rest of the quote from...
So perspective, this is the quote, perspective is nothing less than the skull key that opens all of the locks that imprison our happiness. We might call it a skeleton key, okay, which is a key that opens every lock. Perspective, first pillar of joy related to your mind. Perspective, a quality of the mind. Okay. And just, so it's interesting, please, Andre.
No, I don't want to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Just under the title, Death is Certain,
Can't hear it.
There you go.
Just under the title, Death is Certain, you said that very little time to practice. I'm assuming you're just talking about formal practice, right? Because we can't practice all the time.
Right.
In
right, more formal practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's very little of that formal practice really happening.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just want to clarify.
Yeah. Trying to make more time for retreat, for instance. Okay? Like, how many of you do that? And I can't stress that enough. It goes to a deeper level of all the knowledge you gain, the teachings. So there's this retreat called Light of the Path that's happening around mid-August to mid-September this year, hosted by Kadampa Center and run meticulously well by Madame Donna Cease over here, who's amazing, amazing, truly bodhisattva, incredible. But I want to say something about this retreat. It's about 4 hours away from here near Asheville. It's a little bit of a drive from here. You are the closest center to this retreat. You can go for a weekend. Labor Day falls in this retreat. It's a three-day weekend. Go to the retreat. Sit with a highly qualified master. It will change your cells for the better. Now, I know some of you don't have a relationship with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, but just get a taste of what it's like. Now, there's a lot of prayers and there's some practices we do, but just try to participate in as much of it just to transport yourself out of your normal routine. 3 days, 2-3 days. Give yourself the experience, a little treat. It's a very unique type of retreat the Rinpoche does. It doesn't mean all your retreats are like that. They're all different. If you do retreat on your own, it can be different, and other group retreats. But you couldn't be closer. It's one of the most valuable things you could do this year. I can't stress it enough. I've been to all the retreats, Light of the Path. And it's just, you get a taste of something a little bit different of how you could really spend some time doing some practices, listening to a really qualified person, and see what happens. Yes.
Yeah, since you've given me the opening, I'll just mention that over the years, I've talked to quite a few people from Kadampa Center who, as you said, you know, we don't have a close relationship with Lama Zopa Rinpoche because we don't have that opportunity on a regular basis. But there's something about being there in that retreat setting for several days, and just a lot of people have said, you know, that it really opened something in them, changed something. They really could feel that experience changed them. So I just want to add that to the encouragement to come.
And to also a little bit about, so you can go for longer. You might have a holiday, but on holiday we're going to do something else, right? So people say to me, I'd like to cultivate a relationship with Rinpoche, or I'd like to find a guru. How do you do it? You go to retreats like that. You make the time to do it. That has to become more of a priority. And more we're in a degenerate time, and less people are doing it. I've noticed this over my short little Dharma career, 30-some years, right? The excuses why people are not practicing, not creating a meditation practice, not going to retreats, the excuses are more and more sophisticated now. Seriously. And it's really sad. And a number of my friends who teach talk about it. That just there's so many other distractions that seem to be more succulent. And I remember I met the Dharma in Nepal, and then I moved to San Francisco. Not consciously, I just got a ride. Anyway, I ended up living in San Francisco, and I was working for a magazine. And Vajrapani Institute was an hour and a half, 2 hours south of San Francisco. I didn't have a car, but I knew about it. It was connected to Copan. I was interested. I wanted to go. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche came there one weekend, and I rented a car and went there. That was my weekend. I had a weekend off, and that's what I did. You know, and then he came back a year later, and I went back again and was able to take refuge, and then suddenly wanted to take refuge. And I started to make certain weekends, like one weekend a month, I started making where I was going to go to a retreat at Vajrapani. Did it cost some money? Uh-huh. That's what I saved my money for. That seemed to be valuable. I seemed to really get something out of that. But we can make excuses and go, I don't feel like renting the car. I don't really want to go. One time a friend drove me, and I had to take the bus across town to meet him, and it was a bit of, you know, and people used to make all these sacrifices to kind of, now we don't want anything that's difficult. No, my life, easy. So you're only going to get so far if that's the attitude. I can't stress it enough. like that. And I was just an ordinary person. I wasn't a nun. I had a full-time job. It was a very intense job. I had to pay my bills, my apartment, whatever. And somehow I could manage it. I wasn't making a ton of money, but it's just about priorities. So if you want those kind of things and you want things to unfold in your spiritual practice, you have to make some effort. And the more effort you put in, the more you get back. That's what I found, like that. So enough of that lecture. What, anything else? Any other? So let's take a break for lunch. In the lunch break, again, we're not blah-blahing. If you want to meet somebody new, great. What do you think about perspective? How's your perspective? Yeah. What do you think about the death meditation? Can you incorporate even the simple one of today's mind? What if it's your last meal? How do you want to eat the meal? And how do you want to engage with the people you're buying the food from, sitting with at lunch, talking with them? Could be the last conversation you have. I certainly hope it's not. But you know what I mean? Like, how will you drive if you drive out to work? How are you going to drive if it's the last time you're driving? So can we be a little bit more focused on that kind of thing, thinking about, and some of the things I spoke about this morning. So discuss that. Okay? So quick dedication, any merit we've accumulated from all the effort, the wonderful effort we've made this morning, can we fold it into our fully waking up to benefit all living beings? May the food we're going to eat benefit us to keep our energy and our health good for our afternoon session, for our lives, so that we can again move along a path to Buddhahood to benefit all living beings. With that real effort, that real intention in mind to benefit all living beings is why we would then eat lunch. Thank you.